Hi, this is Mark Cuniberti. You're about to listen to another edition of our award-winning economic show entitled Money Matters. The information given on this show is obtained from a variety of public sources and is deemed accurate at time of airing but is not guaranteed. This show is pre-recorded at an earlier date, so market indices and related stock market references may not be accurate at time of airing, and we will not be taking any listener call-ins. Thanks again for listening. Now enjoy the show.
And welcome to the 226th edition of your economic forum entitled Money Matters. Today's show, is the market rout pausing? Please remember, discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I'm an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Views expressed on today's show are my opinions only. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, this radio station, its staff, members, or underwriters. Money Matters is about money, as money does matter, and matters of money affect us all in some way or another. Whether you have a lot of it, a little of it, or none of it, it controls our economy, our country, our planet, and in some way or another, controls the very way you live your life. It's about your money, your lack of it, or your abundance of it. It's about our lives and livelihood. In short, it's about you. My name's Mark Cuniberti. Thanks for joining me today. On the air since 2005. And fortunately, today, unlike the last three or four shows, I don't have to bring to you humongous, terrible, eye-popping, negative market news today. The Dow, as it stands, Thursday, February 4th, 2016, in the year of our Lord, 12:10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, 16,354 on the Dow. Fairly flat. Last few shows, I've had to come on and say, Dow down 100, Dow down 300, Dow down 400. The January setback was the largest setback for the Dow since it was started for a new year. So what do you think about that? Just seemed like January 1st to third week of January was nothing but down and down and down. Holy mackerel. So we'll talk a little bit about the market, what we can expect coming up here. And, yeah, it has been an interesting time. May you live in interesting times, for sure. And we'll talk about what caused that, but gas prices are tumbling around the country. But things got a little out of hand in Michigan last week. At least three gas stations in the Houghton Lake region engage in a price war that briefly let drivers pay less than 50 cents a gallon. Oh, man. When's the last time you saw that? I have been told that there is a gas station locally that is offering gas at under $2 a gallon. Who would ever thunk, right? If the three stations in Houghton Lake region were looking for attention for their low prices, they got it. Prices at the Beacon and Bridge Market went as low as 47 cents a gallon after starting the day at 177, according to Gas Buddy, a service that allows users to track prices. You can probably check that out on your iPhone. It was crazy. The police were directing traffic. Totally insane, one Beacon and Bridge Market employee told CNN Money. The employer confirmed the 47-cent price, but asked to remain anonymous. Nearby Marathon Gas won up that ridiculous price by slashing gas to 46 cents a gallon, according to Judy Miracle, an employee at the station. Customers were shocked and happy, she said. The Citgo in Houghton Lake was also involved in the price slashing, according to Gas Buddy. And Iran's floating oil stockpile is for sale at the worst time for the market. Obviously, if you're a gas consumer, maybe it's the best time. Gas prices have been dropping across the country, thanks to the crash in crude oil prices below $30 a barrel. National average for a gallon fell to 189. How come I never see 189 where I live? I don't know. We're fairly close to the Richmond refinery, yet somebody said they were in Iowa and gas was dollar something. $1.89. I haven't seen a $1.89 around here. Down from an average price of $3.68 in July 2014. A month ago, the national average was about $2 a gallon, according to AAA. But don't expect to fill up your tank for 50 cents a gallon anytime soon. The Michigan price war appears to be more of a publicity stunt than part of the broader trend of falling prices. Gas Buddy. Again, I think you can go there on the web. Said all three stations that cut these prices are known to have previously engaged in one-off price wars. It's a quirk, a gimmick, a lark, and not anything related to the oil price collapse, said Tom Kloza, global head of the energy analysis at the Oil Price Information Service. The price strategy might draw attention, but at a cost. Given wholesale costs and state and federal taxes, pricing a gallon at 46 cents is basically like selling free gas, Kloza said. You know, we always hear about the government looking out for us. And they go after the oil companies for excessive profits. But I think the person making, the entity making the most off your gas is the federal government and state through all their taxes. If they were concerned about lowering our gas bill when gas was high, why did they not cut the taxes we pay? Oh, no, they're not going to do that. In fact, I heard talk that some states are looking at increasing the gas tax to make up for the percentage paid because the price of gas is falling. How do you like that? Anytime we find a way to make things cheaper or things get cheaper because of supply and demand, the government seems to want a piece of the cheapness. They don't ever want us to save money, do they? That's my opinion, of course. And, of course, massive debt levels encompass central banks and countries worldwide, of course. Historic debt levels. We have a historic deficit here in the United States, somewhere around $19 trillion. And remember the sequester cuts of a few years ago that was supposed to be automatic and mandatory, cutting about $100 billion of government spending per year for 10 years? With the sole goal of saving $1 billion. Let's see, $100 billion or $1 trillion over 10 years. I think we did that for 2 years. The sequester cuts were thrown out with the latest budget proposal and agreement in December. So the sequester cuts have gone the way of the dodo. You know, they actually have a frozen dodo. So there is, they, when something goes extinct, they, if they can, they freeze a copy of it. They freeze a bird. So there's a frozen dodo somewhere. Take a look at it. And, of course, we have Puerto Rico saying that they cannot afford to pay their debt. They owe about $50 billion. They want to hack the debt in half. And Argentina, of course, has debt problems of its own. Who doesn't? Well, I found a very strange article out from Bloomberg, which I thought was very odd. Now, Argentina obviously has problems, economic problems. They have trouble paying their debt. So if you knew someone has trouble paying their debt, would you loan them money? Especially if you're in the business of loaning money and watching out for risk. Out from Bloomberg last week, Argentina's central bank reached terms with seven Wall Street banks for $5 billion of loans. What could be behind that? We have known before when big banks have held debt from certain governments and entities that the central banks of the area which those banks reside have stepped in to bail them out, such as the Mexican peso crisis and the Asian contagion and, of course, our recent bout of 08 and 09 where the Federal Reserve embarked on asset purchases of toxic mortgages, according to the Federal Reserve's own website. $5 billion, seven Wall Street banks have agreed to loan to Argentina. They can't possibly think they're going to pay them back. Is it possible that they were offered a guarantee by a central bank somewhere? Is it possible? The one-year loan will be backed by sovereign bonds, IOUs, according to an emailed statement from the central bank. Argentina has been seeking to shore up its central bank reserves after years of currency controls and policies that discouraged investment and depleted the country's supply of dollars. Unable to borrow money internationally on the bond markets because of a decade-long feud with previous creditors left over from the nation's 2001 default, the country, Argentina's cash hoard, dropped to a 9-year low last month. Next week, officials will begin settlement talks with holders of some defaulted bonds who won a U.S. court order requiring they be paid in full. Good luck with that. HSBC Holdings, J.P. Morgan, Chase & Company, and Banco Santander, S.A., are each providing $1 billion in loans, according to three people familiar with the matter who asked not to be identified because the information is private, according to the Bloomberg article. Deutsche Bank AG, Banco Bilbao, Vizcaya Argentaria, S.A., Citigroup Inc. and UBS Group AG will each provide $500 million, the people said. The interest rate is LIBOR plus 6.15 percentage points. Whoa. Wow. That's a lot of money loaned at definitely a premium. 6.15% plus LIBOR. Holy mackerel. Press officials for Citigroup, Santander, J.P. Morgan, and HSBC declined to comment on the loan. Officials at BBVA, Deutsche Bank, UBS, and Argentina's finance ministry didn't immediately reply to a request for comment as well. The central bank also declined to comment beyond its published statement. Wow. And Finance Secretary Luis Caputo will meet debt mediator Daniel Polak February 1st and 2nd, which is what, a couple days ago, in New York to begin the process of opening negotiations with the holdout creditors, according to a ministry official. After bolstering its reserves through the loans, Argentine authorities will have more bargaining power in the talks, according to Hernan Yalati, the head of research and strategy at Bank Trust and Company. Okay. They say, he says, this is a good way of raising confidence and increasing reserves so that the government of Argentina can negotiate with the holdouts without an urgency, because they now have a little money to put that off. My words there. That might put Argentina in a situation where they need to accept worse terms. It's a positive step, Hernan Yalati said from Miami. Argentina's reserve rose by $4.8 billion Friday to $30 billion. Okay. Well, what do you think about that? This is one country after another, doesn't it? Just amazing. One country after another. You have to wonder. And Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico. I was in Puerto Rico just a couple of weeks ago, months ago, I think. Kind of walked around, saw the old forts. It was pretty cool. The coolest thing I did is I took a jet ski ride. Now, it was only an hour, and it was pretty cheap. I remember it was like $80. Compared to all the other tours, it was like an hour. Well, they'd pick you up, and then they'd drive you there, and then put you on a scooter, and then they'd take you back all within an hour. I thought, well, how much time could I get really riding? Well, it was the best thing going, really. The ride was fairly short, and they stuck you on one of these jet skis. Impossible to tip over. I tried to tip the thing over. And they led you out in this inlet, very calm water, not very deep, but you know, jet skis don't have much of a draft anyway. We rode around crazy. And then they kind of peeled off the faster riders and took us out to the mouth of the river where the river met the ocean. And believe you me, it was choppy. And they took us out in the ocean. I couldn't believe it, man. I was dipping the nose in 3 or 4 foot waves, and it was great. Couldn't believe they'd take you out there. You drowned out there. A lot of people didn't want to go out there, but I went with a couple people. It was fun. Then they took us back and let us jet around some more. It was a blast. It was really fun. So that was Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico released details of a proposal to restructure
the Commonwealth's debt that would reduce the burden by 46% under a bond exchange, making negotiations with creditors public as it seeks to convince U.S. lawmakers that its obligations are unsustainable. Now, did you know, for some odd reason, Puerto Rican bonds are free from federal and state taxes? It's a Commonwealth, an area of the United States, not a state, obviously. I just thought that was strange. You know, while taking a Series 65 securities test, they had that question on there, and they'd prompted us before, you know, that they were tax-free, and I thought, that's weird, you know, that it would be tax-free. I mean, if you live in California and you buy a certain California bond, a certain type of bond, it's tax-free. Not all California bonds are tax-free, but certain types are in California. And state bonds are free from federal taxes, and federal bonds are likewise from the states, kind of an agreement they made. But Puerto Rican bonds, they were free from both. The Commonwealth, Puerto Rico, tax-supported debt, that's the key there, would be reduced to $26.5 billion from $49.2 billion, cut in half. And annual payments would be capped at 15% of government revenue, according to the statement Monday from officials of the island of Puerto Rico. Creditors would also get the opportunity to recover the principal amount of their investments under the proposal, although no details are given on that. Ultimately, says Matt Dalton, chief executive officer of Rybrook, New York-based Belen Heaven Investments, which oversees $3.8 billion of municipal bonds, including Puerto Rico securities, said, you ultimately got to believe that there's compromise somewhere between 46% and something less than that. They put the offer out there, and now it's time to work it up from there. Puerto Rico and its agencies, so says this article, piled on debt by borrowing for years to fulfill budget deficits. Sound familiar? Governor Alejandro Garcia Padilla in June said he would seek to reduce the island's obligations by asking investors to take losses on the securities or wait longer to be repaid. Like I said, there's no free lunches. Someone always has to pay. So when you get a check from the government or they subsidize something for you, someone else has paid. It's not free. Puerto Rican authority defaulted for the first time in August. And the administration in December began redirecting revenue used to repay agency debt to instead pay general obligation bonds, forcing a second authority to default January 4th. Kind of like a domino game. Right now, Puerto Rico is not able to file for bankruptcy, but Garcia Padilla has asked that the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico and its agencies be given access to the bankruptcy protection so that officials may reorganize. Republicans in the U.S. House of Representatives are holding a hearing, or held a hearing, to explore the case for setting up a Puerto Rico Financial Control Authority, another body of government. Kind of wondered what Puerto Ricans' bonds paid. Puerto Ricans' benchmark general obligation with an 8% payment due in July 2035 was being marketed at 71.1 cents on the dollar, down from 72.1 cents on the dollar in January. That data from Bloomberg. There's a restructuring proposal asked that creditors exchange existing securities for two new securities, a base bond with a fixed interest rate and an amortization schedule, and a growth bond, which is payable only if the Commonwealth's revenue exceeds certain levels. Good luck with that? Question mark? Oh, man. Just doesn't seem to stop, does it? So stock market right now, Dow up 50, 16,387. We'd mentioned on previous shows there were some support and resistant levels that analysts look at. I myself had named one at 16,300. Of course, it blew through that, and then the next number was 16,157. Depending on which analyst you look at or talk to, those resistance levels can change. So we are sitting 16,003.
On the way down, it's called support. On the way up, it's called resistance. So we're right around a support level. So we'll see. At least the market has stopped. It's 400 points up, down, round that we've been seeing. So contrast to January, it is more stable. Doesn't mean it will remain more stable. It just in the last 2 weeks, we haven't seen this constant bloodletting that we saw in January. Wow. That was ugly. Recall back in August, we saw a 1,000-point drop in the first few minutes of an opening on a Monday. It appeared to me that this slow drop we saw in January was indeed painful for a lot of people, a lot of securities got hit. And so we look, you know, at what are they doing with all this debt. And, of course, we've talked about, you know, this show is called Money Matters. I think if I didn't call it Money Matters, I would call it Money Printing. But Money Matters was kind of like a double entendre, like money matters, like money does matter. Or money matters, like things that surround money. So there's, did you catch that? Monetary money printing programs, such as quantitative easing and asset purchases from the Federal Reserve and other central banks to buy debt from the banking sector and other entities, causes the quantity of dollars in the economy to increase. So much like a bumper crop of bananas, when you increase the quantity of bananas, let's say it rains bananas for some odd reason, this would cause the prices of bananas to fall. Well, the same takes place for dollars. If you increase the quantity of dollars in a system and they're out there in the system, the price of each dollar falls. However, you can't equate that to the price of a banana. How can the price of a dollar fall? Well, it means its purchasing power falls. And we know that as inflation. If the dollar gets stronger, they say the dollar is stronger today, then its purchasing power increases. And we know that as deflation. So the theory goes, increase the amount of dollars, print up more dollars, and the prices of goods rise. Take dollars out of the system, and the prices of goods fall. However, the inflation in a specific area is specific to that area. It means that if you create more U.S. dollars, this causes the price of something to go up only in U.S. dollars. So let's say you have a certain amount of U.S. dollars and a Swiss watch costs 1,000 U.S. dollars, okay? And it also costs 1,000 Swiss francs. If you increase U.S. dollars in the system but do not increase the francs in the system, the price of the watch in dollars will go up. For example, it might go to 1,050, but priced in Swiss francs. If the quantity of Swiss francs has not been increased, the watch remains at 1,000 Swiss francs. So that's what happens when you increase the quantity of a currency against not increasing the quantity of another currency. Currencies, of course, can be arbitrarily created by willing governments that control that specific currency. The measuring stick of currencies used to be the price of gold. You would measure your dollar worth in how much gold it would buy. That is no longer the case. We did away with the gold standard. Bretton Woods, way back after when it was established, I think after World War II, kind of had gold as a backing. And when Nixon closed the gold window, pretty much took us off the gold standard altogether. The measuring stick now against a currency is another currency or a basket of other currencies. They are, for the most part, one currency is measured against another or measured against a basket of another. Hence, when the U.S. dollar goes down in value, for example, the Swiss franc might go up.
A product bought using U.S. dollars, like the watch, might rise in price in dollars, while the same product purchased in francs may stay the same or even fall. This inverse relationship of currencies has a unique and noticeable effect when it comes to exports, what we sell to foreigners, and imports, what we buy from foreigners. If the U.S. prints more dollars and therefore causes inflation here, our currency gets weaker, it is said. And therefore, when imports come into the country, the imports are more expensive because it takes more dollars to buy something that's coming in from another country. But conversely, it makes our exports cheaper to foreigners. And I know it's kind of like bonds and interest rates that move inverse of each other. It's kind of a difficult concept to grasp, and I sympathize with you all out there. But you sit down on a piece of paper or just kind of think it through sometime. And when we print more dollars here, things get cheaper for them over there. But when we buy stuff like Swiss watches, it gets more expensive here. So if we print more dollars and we cause inflation here, our corporations make more money because they can sell more overseas because the products over there cost less. But it also causes you and I to pay more for everything we buy here. Weaker dollar, we pay more if we pay in dollars. Stronger dollar, we pay less if we pay in dollars. For you conspiracy buffs out there, if the government was for the corporations, by the corporations, and of the corporations, and not for the little guy, a money printing propensity would seem to confirm this. So if the government is printing money, knowing that it will save the corporations some money because they would sell more overseas, does that confirm the government is for the corporations, by the corporations, and of the corporations? By printing more dollars, our corporations do sell more overseas. But since this inverse relationship works against a foreigner's currency as well, then we pay more for imported stuff. And when we pay more for imported stuff, we don't buy as much from foreign corporations. See how that works? So what happens is these foreign corporations start selling less, so they go to their governments and they demand that they print more of their currency to keep up with ours. So we weaken our currency, then our exports get cheaper overseas, and then Switzerland may cheapen their currency in retaliation against us, so their exports get cheaper over here, and they go back and forth. So it's this cheapening of a currency here, and another guy does it over there, and another guy does it in response, and another guy does it in response because it helps corporations every time you make more of your own dollars because things get cheaper. And it encompasses a tit-for-tat monetary policy. And countries are indeed practicing that as we speak. It all adds up to a grand money printing race commonly referred to here and from other people as a currency war. Of course, the U.S. is being the leader as it's the largest consumer of goods in the world and more of our currency is out there than anybody. In essence, when we here embark on massive money printing to, one, help the corporations, two, money printing to fund itself, money printing to support bailouts, it forces the rest of the world's governments to retaliate by printing more on their end. It's a grand race and an odd sense of conception to devalue each other's currency against the others so everyone's corporations sell more. But when you go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, the net effect is what? You hit me, I hit you, you hit me, I hit you, you hit me, I hit you. Nobody really wins, except both people come out pretty bruised. What happens is, however, is the population of each nation is doomed to higher prices. Because if both countries are printing a lot of dollars, the prices for goods go up for both of us, for the little people over there and the little people over here. In conclusion, the U.S. is the biggest importer of the world. We still buy more than anybody else. But we are also the biggest exporter by exporting our inflation by massive money printing programs. through the programs called quantitative easing, open market operations, asset purchases, both which have taken place on a massive scale since the crisis of 2008. We will return to your economic forum, Money Matters. Stay tuned.
Times is hard, times is tough, nothing's easy, it's all rough. There's not much right, so much gone wrong. All I can do is play this song. You're watching the news, it all looks bad. The worst half hour you ever had. What in God's name is going on? All I can do is play this song. You're losing your job, your house and your car. Hitting rock bottom, don't feel that far. Nothing good is gonna come along. All I can do is play this song. Folks are scared watching that news. Folks feel
oh, yeah. Got that CD from a listener, sent that CD, and thank you very much. Got a lot of cool songs on there. And, of course, I know you're all concerned about the markets out there. What's coming? What happened? Well, with the markets now again in turmoil, and even Washington acknowledging the recovery is starting to look like a no-show. The recovery, right? We've been in a recovery since 09. Remember Bernanke, 2010, went on 60 Minutes and says, we're starting to see green shoots. With those weeds? Investors, of course, you out there, even if you don't have any securities or stock, just working, you're wondering if we are indeed in for another meltdown or just a temporary soft patch. I guess we've all heard that word before, soft patch. A lot of soft patches, right? Problems, what caused it all? Well, stemming from the ongoing European debt crisis, who knows? Rumors about a continuing banking concern. Bank stocks have been fairly well hammered lately. Combined with a slow-moving economy and, of course, a market that is bleeding red ink, or was, maybe putting a dampener on investor enthusiasm. Are you less enthusiastic as a stockholder? What about as a general working stiff? Are you less enthusiastic about your job, your prospects, your customers coming in? The latest consumer confidence numbers are not the best. And a Dow Jones Industrial Average falling attests to new stresses in financial markets. 7 years or so after the economies of the world nearly imploded from the real estate bust, and with trillions of bailout money now gone and spent, the crisis that many thought was behind us may once again be rearing its ugly head. The reason that we are seeing new volatility in both the banking sector and the markets, just look at some stock prices of some big popular banks, you know. It might shock you. Look at the stock prices, what they've done. It's because the underlying problem was most likely misunderstood, in my opinion, by monetary authorities around the globe and the opinion of other analysts. You need to look no farther for proof of that statement by something that Luc Guin, governor of Belgium's central bank, who told French-language daily newspaper La Libre Belgique, the chief problem in Europe is that of liquidity. I think I covered this 2 weeks ago. Many analysts think this is not a liquidity problem, but a solvency problem. Now, what's the difference between liquidity and solvency? They sound the same, but there is a difference. As described in the last show, liquidity can be detailed as you ask me for 10 bucks that I owe you and I tell you I have the 10 bucks but I don't have it on me. I have it, but it's not on me. I have a liquidity problem. I have the money, but it's just not available to me right now. In this case, if I get a loan from a third party, it will solve my liquidity problem. He gives me the loan, I give it to the person I own 10 bucks and I go back home and I get the 10 bucks and I pay back the third party. Now, a solvency problem is a little bit different. I owe you the 10 bucks and you ask me to pay you, and not only do I not have the 10 bucks on me, I don't have the 10 bucks. I no longer have a liquidity problem because I am not solvent. I now have a solvency problem. Trillions of dollars in home loans, IOUs, Back in the crisis, were sliced dice packaged up into complicated asset offerings, tranches, mortgage-backed securities, collateralized debt obligations. Sold worldwide. Rating agencies rated a lot of it AAA, so everybody could buy it. Eventually, debt markets everywhere were saturated with mortgage-backed securities, collateralized debt obligations, and all sorts of other stuff. When the housing market imploded, everybody went to sell everything, and many of these IOUs became worthless. After all, if everybody's selling the same thing and there are no buyers, you have a problem. Now, normally, when we have too much debt, the only way to get rid of debt is you do what? You either pay it off, which couldn't have been done at the time, or you discount it. You don't pay as much, like Argentina and Puerto Rico are trying to do, or you don't pay anything. You default on it. What the central banks did, because we had a solvency problem, okay? They didn't have the money. They didn't have the money anywhere. So remember, think back. If I had the money somewhere, it was liquidity. But if I didn't have the money anywhere, it was a solvency problem, okay? And we already decided a solvency problem can't be solved by a loan. Because you give me the loan and I pay back the first party, I still don't have the money to pay the third party back. Well, central banks, in the face of this solvency problem, made more loans to backstop the original ones, essentially borrowing from Peter to pay Paul, you being Peter. So the banks still owe the money, they just now owe it to the Federal Reserve. Now, the Federal Reserve has decided to take all those IOUs, mortgage-backed securities, and collateralized debt obligations, and just keep them. So they're basically saying, you don't have to pay me back, I'll just keep them. I'll keep the IOUs. So the debt never really went away. It was just transferred from everybody who held them now into the central banks. The central banks have the debt. The amount of liquidity in the system was never the issue. It was solvency. By allowing all those loans to survive, which they are still there on the central bank's books, they're still there. They haven't gone away. Financial institutions, central banks, and entire countries holding this stuff are still insolvent, according to some. And no amount of money conjured up to fill their operating balance sheets will make that disappear. Because remember, when the Federal Reserve or central banks creates a dollar, it says right on the dollar, note. Note. Note means debt, right? You loan your brother money and he writes you a note. Don't have to take my word for it. Just look on the dollar. It says note. Much like a housewife gone crazy with credit cards, you can pay off this month's bills, but next month you have the same problem. Couple that with higher government deficits from spending to stimulate the economy. The amount of debt and IOU that now exists in markets everywhere are soaking up any and all monies tossed at them. Like the proverbial hungry alligator, whose appetite can never be satiated unless we get rid of the debt. It will continue to reappear in many forms. And we're seeing it reappear. Puerto Rico, Argentina. The alligator gets bigger and bigger because of the interest, right? You not only owe the principal, there's interest due. So it grows and grows, like the proverbial housewife spending on credit cards. This is why we hear about the bailouts to Greece, Spain, Portugal, Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae, the FHA, and who else, who knows who else, is getting larger with each new headline. I mean, $50 billion ago, 15 years ago, was a tremendous amount of money. I mean, we bailed out long-term capital management in 1997. They only needed $5 billion, and that was like, wow, that was an amazing amount of money. Now you got a little dot, like Puerto Rico, wanting to shave off $26 billion, five times the amount of the long-term capital management fiasco. So I would say, to solve the problem, we must first recognize the problem. You can't solve a solvency problem. You can't solve a debt problem by amassing more debt. Each time you cover each feeding with another round of bailouts, loans, or stimulus, or whatever you call it, it's more debt, and it creates more debt because of the interest. The deficit figures coming from Washington and other central banks seems to confirm this.
It's a movie done, I think, in 06, 07. I think we previewed it. It's called IOUSA. And it was constructed, it was made, helped produced by David Walker, former Comptroller General of the United States. David Walker, we had him on the show. And they were going through about how massive the debt was and how it was unpayable. It was $9 trillion when that movie was made. Today, it stands at $19 trillion. We just crossed over the $19 trillion mark in the last 2 weeks. The solution lies in repudiating the debt, either through default, not paying it, or discount. You don't give the banks as much money for the loan as they say it's worth. But because the debt is held by the world's most powerful institutions, and even central banks, a lot of that stuff is held by the central banks of the world, the killing off of these massive debts would likely cause tremendous upheaval and financial convulsions in markets worldwide. And this is what the central bankers of the world are desperately trying to avoid. They keep having to print up more and more money and greater amounts of it to make the banks liquid when it's not a liquidity problem, it's a solvency issue. The first step in solving a problem is recognizing the problem. So I would ask you, can you solve a debt problem by amassing more debt? You're listening to Money Matters on Community Radio Station. We'll be right back.
All hail to Mr. Roosevelt, you're the hero of the hour. We sent you on to Washington, bestowed on you full power. This country is a vast domain, its finest spot on earth. We've worked and struggled, fought and won every conflict since our birth. On the victory, Mr. Roosevelt, we'll need one mighty strong. Now that you're our president, we know it won't be long till folks are happy once again and singing this glad song. Mr. Roosevelt, we're back of you 120 million strong. So cut expense, tear down the fence between supply and demand. Put folks to work, don't let them shirk. Let farmers keep their land. They don't need cash to cut a dash. There's faith in those we trust. So when they say that they will pay, they will not go and bust. On the victory, Mr. Roosevelt, we'll need one mighty strong. Now that you're our president, we know it won't be long till folks are happy once again and singing this glad song. Mr. Roosevelt, we're back of you 120 million strong. So onward, noble president, we pledge our faith in you. 'Cause when we see your smiling face, we never can be blue. So smile and pray, work hard each day, and soon things will be bright. The sun will shine, we'll all be fine, everything will be all right. On the victory, Mr. Roosevelt, we'll need one mighty strong. Now that you're our president, we know it won't be long till folks are happy once again and singing this glad song. Mr. Roosevelt, we're back of you 120 million strong. Let's look into the future now, many years from today.
And you're tuned to KVMR FM in Nevada City, your community radio station, or on a community radio station of your choosing throughout the United States, wherever you're listening to this show. Thank you for joining me. My name is Mark Cunaberti. This is Money Matters, show number 226. And Money Matters airs us the first and third Thursdays, usually, of the month at 12 noon Pacific Standard Time, although it is carried pre-recorded or post-recorded, or you would say that, on other stations throughout the U.S. You can send emails to your program director at the station for questions and comments on the show, and they can always forward them to me. So I would ask, I would resurrect another article that I wrote. Oh, I've been using strategies such as this for quite some time. I wrote an article on this, and it's about stop losses, limiting losses. I would preface this idea that I'd like you to consider by saying that most investors took major losses on their portfolios in 08 and 09.
Did you?
And of course, probably because of plunging stock prices. Because of the obvious stock price plunge, there are some basic strategies that may have mitigated some of those losses, yet few investors utilize them. One of the most important aspects of investing, which I'm sure you heard of, is not to lose money, and I think all investors have lost money at some point or another. But next to losing money, at least minimizing the possibility of loss, is probably preferable than taking a massive one. A critical strategy in not losing money is having an exit point on your stocks or securities, yet few advisors or investors have an exit point. An exit point, what is it? It's a predetermined level or price that you would sell your security. There's a common mindset that prevents investors from limiting losses with a predetermined sell point, and it works like this. Let's assume the market starts to fall and an investor is looking at a 5% loss. The investor or the advisor handling the portfolio thinks and says, we're only down 5%. It's not enough to worry about. If the portfolio drops 10, the same excuse is used to hold. Now it drops 15, 20, and 25. They keep saying it's not down far enough. If the market continues its descent somewhere along the line, usually between 25 or 30%, maybe more, the investor or the advisor then suddenly switches his mindset from you're not down far enough to you're down too far. You can't sell. Heard that one before? Thought that one before? What happened is the change in thought process never allowed for sell strategy. In essence, there was never an exit point. A point where the investor says, I'm down 24% or 25% or whatever the number is, so I'm out. I would say consider the investors are lucky the market stopped back then where it did. For if it hadn't, the mindset of you're down too far to sell now would have convinced investors and most advisors to continue to ride the market down to wherever the market stopped. Because if you're down 30 and you're down too far to sell, down 50 would certainly be down too far to sell. Not having an exit point means the investor never had a chance, in my mind. Unlike leaving a casino after you've lost a certain amount. In other words, when you're in a casino, you keep gambling, you keep losing. You eventually say, okay, I lost $200, I'm gone. In stocks, most investors don't practice the same control. They would practice sitting at a slot machine. You don't sit at a slot machine down 200 and go to your ATM and say, well, I'm down too far now, I'm just going to keep gambling. Not having an exit point, I've always considered comparable to never leaving a house that's on fire. You may not leave for a small fire in your oven, but you sure would get the heck out if the kitchen became engulfed. That the investor or the advisors flop from you're not down far enough to you're down too far to sell now never allows for the cut the loss and run. There never was a fire escape. Or a point at which the investor, much like playing a losing slot machine, gets up and leaves. This common fault among investors leaves them open to massive losses and years of accumulated profits vanishing in one severe crash. I myself have been victim of that. Though this stock's too good to sell, it'll come back. I don't think there's an investor out there that never had that conflict in his brain. Interestingly enough, there is a point some investors will sell their stocks, and it's a well-known point to market historians. When the average investor is down massively, I mean a lot, the investor or their significant other suddenly panics and say, we've got to get out with something, and may liquidate at the very bottom, along with millions of other investors, usually resulting in what is called a final capitulation sell-off. The markets experience one final brutal fall. This selling at the bottom is classic among small-time retail investors, that's you and I. And it's the reason why years of gains seem to vanish in a market crash. Ironically, at the same time most investors reach this capitulation point, that is usually the time when the smart money starts buying. Establishing a sell point, either by a stock price or a percentage of money that you lost, might be a strategy you might consider. Much like a fire escape, know when it's time to get out before the whole thing goes down in flames. You're listening to Money Matters on your community radio station. We'll be right back to wrap up the show. I want to thank you for listening to your Economic Forum show, Money Matters, on your community radio station. Again, we welcome your emails. Just email the program director at the station you're hearing the show on, and they can pass it on to me. Please remember, the discussions on this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Always consult with your investment professional before making important investment decisions. I am an investment advisor representative through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. The views expressed on Money Matters are my opinions only. They do not necessarily reflect those of Cambridge, this station, its staff, members, or underwriters. Stay tuned for your fine programming that's coming up on your community radio station. My name's Mark Cuniberti. Have a great day.
This has been another edition of Money Matters. Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed on this show are those of myself and my guests, and are opinions only, and may not represent those of this station, its staff, members, or underwriters. This show is not meant as investment advice. Consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions, and do your own research before investing. The information given on the show was obtained from a variety of public sources and is deemed accurate at time of airing, but is not guaranteed. This show was pre-recorded at an earlier date, so the market indices and related stock market references may not be accurate at the time of airing. You can order past shows or comment on our show by sending me an email at mark@moneymanagementradio.com. Money Matters is produced and recorded at the studios of KVMR FM 89.5 in Nevada City, California. You can visit our website at moneymanagementradio.com. Thanks for listening.